29 and a half minutes past seven, Monday night's arena. When Samuel Beckett died in 1989, little was known about the playwright's heroic involvement in the French resistance movement in World War II. He was, in fact, awarded the French Croix de Guerre in 1945. But this, along with much of the detail of his life, remained hidden under his absolute determination to keep his private life private. New play, Beckett's Room, opens next week as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. It's a co-production between the Gate Theatre and Dead Centre. And with me in studio now, one of the directors, Bush McCarzel, and the co-writer and collaborator, Mark O'Halloran. Beckett, 1942, Paris. How do you find out what he was doing in this flat with Suzanne, as you kind of make up in the midst of this play, Bush?
Sure. I mean, we get the broad coordinates from the biographies. There's Dam to Fame, James Nelson's famous biography of that. That gives you the broad coordinates of what he was up to and what kind of work he was doing for the resistance. What kind of jokes they were telling each other, it's conjecture, you know? But we had a sense of what they could or couldn't be drinking and eating with the war rations on, and, you know, you were pissed off they were having barley coffee as opposed to the real stuff with the caffeine kick in it. And you can get a flavour of the day-to-day world.
Yeah, what really struck me, Mark, in the script was Bush is saying there, you know, what kind of jokes they were telling each other is kind of a matter of conjecture. But the play reads in some ways like a Samuel Beckett play in terms of its humour. It has many of the qualities that his humour would have.
Well, I suppose there's a darkness to some of the humour because it's gallows humour in lots of ways, because they're facing the war and they're facing having to exile themselves and they're facing all of that. And
they're in mortal peril.
They're in terrible danger. Yeah. I mean, they came close to being arrested.
I think 10 minutes, they were 10 minutes from the Gestapo raiding the apartment, 10 minutes between when they fled Suzanne de Chevaux de Meny, who was the partner and later wife of Beckett. They fled the apartment and 10 minutes later the Gestapo had raided it, and, you know, they'd be in the concentration camps if they had been caught. So
and
it was a close call.
They'd have come out of that situation. Yeah. But knowing that peril and then looking for this gallows humour, there must have been a great joy and, I guess, fun in that.
Well, there is that. There's that. I think it was George Bernard Shaw said, if you're going to tell the truth, you better make him laugh. And there's a kind of, there's a bit of that goes on. And he was, I find his writing terribly funny. And it is dealing with the darkness and the impossibilities of continuing on when you have to continue on.
And the idea is he comes out of the war in 1945, sits down 47 to 49, and that's when he writes this unknown play called Eleutheria, which is officially his first play, but that's for another day. And then Waiting for Godot, and then the trilogy of novels, Malone Dies the Unable, basically the works that made him win the Nobel Prize. So he comes out of this very particular historical moment and writes what everyone sees to be abstract, comic, universal masterpieces. But they are a reaction to a very specific war, you know, world torn apart by
There's
war.
Also a wonderful character from Downstairs. Madame Carl.
Yeah.
Is she a total invention, the concierge?
The concierge, well, the role, and there was a lot of fear around the time of concierges being conspirators with the Nazis. So that kind of fear of who's listening in to what you're saying, whether it be the audience or the concierge, and being careful of what you say, that comes from the historical context. But apart from that, she's made up.
You know, there's also, you know, she's a made-up character, so you don't have to stick with the historical facts. You give us some gags, but you also you can make her as disturbing and dark and funny as you like, and that was quite joyful actually doing that.
Yeah, I also love the fact that she's there all the time, kind of peek at Beckett's notebook, which at one level is quite funny because we know Beckett goes on to be the great writer that he became. But at the other level, it's quite sinister because if she is collaborating with the Nazis, they might be in trouble from some of the things
that Beckett's writing. I mean, that style that came in, you know, of modernism at that time was often confused to be code. I mean, when Beckett made his way from... he was making his way back to Ireland, but he went via London after the war. He had a manuscript of Watt, his novel, and the British intelligence seized it and thought it was code because it was just strange, sort of enigmatic modernist prose.
Hiberno English.
So that was, you know, that kind of, it was in the air, whether this was poetry or you know, sensitive intelligence was the big issue.
But as a result, Madame Carl then kind of comes up to give us a little bit of a performance at one stage. She has notions of the stage, doesn't she?
She was a theatrical lady herself in the past.
This sounds like an invention of yours, Mark, or is this collaboration?
No, this is collaboration. They were his bits. She worked in the Marionette Theatre or the Puppet Theatre and before it was closed down. So she does a puppet show. Yeah. That's quite dark. Now, sinister.
So far, so good. And you think, oh, yeah, right, this is a play that has, is talking about Beckett. And, oh, you're right, okay, I'm going to see these characters have to act this out and the tension and all of the rest.
But there's a twist.
There's a twist. There are no Mark O'Halloran, actor. There are no actors on stage.
I'm having my revenge on actors.
There are no actors on stage.
There's a recorded text. So we did give actors jobs for this gig. So there's no actors been put out of work.
Nine characters in the show. So there's lots of voices, and the technique is basically a play performed by ghosts. Even though there's no actors on stage, the idea is there's a lot to look at. I mean, it's a spectacle of wires and strings and magnets and video tricks and illusions. So, you know, a character, a cigarette lifts up from an ashtray, floats in the air, you hear the inhale, and then you see the exhale, the smoke comes out of nowhere.
So it's like that beer ad on the telly, is it? Was that the inspiration?
But it turns out doing it live is really, really hard. So you can't do it in post as you could on the telly. So it's really a sort of, you know, trying to make a mysterious piece in the vein of Beckett. I mean, with Beckett's theatre, he was very interested in pushing the limits of how you tell a story on stage, whether it be, could you just show a mouth? Could you just show somebody in a mound of earth in Happy Days? Could you show people in dustbins? What are the limitations?
Yeah, but doesn't he have one play that is literally lights up to the sound of breath and hold lights down?
Breath. Oh, yeah, always look, there's no doubt about it.
Off and voices.
Say again, Mark?
There are plenty of hidden voices as well, voices off. There's, footfalls and things like that. There's the voice of the mother, comes A. Joe. There's voices there that aren't embodied on the stage.
Which was another thing that really struck me when I was reading the script was the care with which the stage directions are written. And I know I asked on the way in tonight.
That's him.
I asked, who wrote the stage directions? That was you, Bush.
The reason why they had to be done with such care is because our team of designer Andrew Clancy, who did the set and designed all the tricks, if you wrote something like a book lifts up and goes down, then that's 2 days' work for him, because he has to do the whole mechanism that can write something. So you have to be very careful if you say what cup moves where, because the stage is rigged in a way to pull off this kind of strange space.
It was an interesting technical piece of writing as well, because, you know, with stuff, you know, you could say he looks down at the ring on his finger and exhales, and then you go, oh God, there's no hand, there's no ring, there's no, oh!
Yeah, he says with a smile, maybe.
But, and also there was technical things, like something has got to be moving. We've got to move something on the stage or the arena goes dead. Yeah. So you have to animate it constantly. So
yeah, the way you're moving your pages there, Sean, and the way like a chair might be moving a little bit here, we'd look for those signs. What are the signs around the people that show, that locate the person? And these are the kind of tricks we've
been doing. See, for example, the imprint of a bottom on a chair.
I should hope so.
Somebody was saying
definitely. All that.
Yeah, and language is an issue here as well. And there's a great little section around, there are two German officers at one point, and the Irish language comes up and Beckett's relationship or non-relationship with that. And there's French, there's German, and there's English. We'll have surtitles no matter what.
There's a bit of crack in the subtitles too, but I won't give it all away.
All right. So, yeah, I didn't think it'd be straightforward. Yeah. How important was that, you know, polylingual aspect of things in the writing?
Well, it was important to Beckett. I mean, in the sense of he left Ireland, you know, he was somebody like Joyce who was looking outside to join up Irish art to the European avant-garde. He was a European thinker, European kind of writer and artist, and believed in bringing all those disciplines and cultures together, and unfortunately we're at a time again historically where we've still got to be praying for that and pushing for that. You know, seems self-evident that we'd want to stay together. I'm English, so you could hear, you know, what I'm feeling about all those issues. So you know, that was Beckett's project, and so it was part of this one. It was just a self-evident feeling that there'd be many languages in it, and you know,
we should mention who's playing the part of Beckett, even though he physically might be present some night, but he won't be present on stage.
Yes, Brian Gleeson, a wonderful actor. I knew him from being in a Druid show years ago, way back when, and he's just got the smarts for it, and he's threw himself into the whole discipline. When you take on a real-life character, you do the homework and you start with the voice, and we found Beckett's voice, which is very peculiar, you know, 1930s Fox Rock kind of Anglo-Irish lost voice, really, a kind of voice you don't hear so much anymore, and he sort of built something on that. And he had to learn French because Beckett was very fluent in French, so he had to learn how to have a good handle on the speaking of it. So, yeah, Brian's done a fantastic job.
All right, and you were saying that the other actors are quite well-known internationally, but they wouldn't necessarily be household names.
Yeah, people coming from the Schaubühne in Berlin, Vivian de Moink, a massive star in Belgium, you know, will sell it out on her name alone when it hits the road, this show. So, yeah, big names on the, you know, in the international scene.
And
well,
no per diems for the actors when he goes on tour.
But the easiest gig ever. You get to sit at home and you're in a show in the Dublin Theatre Festival.
Yeah, wherever, yeah.
Collecting the royalties. Yeah.
One, just before we finish up, Mark, I wanted to ask you about your own film, Rialto.
Yes, it just premiered just lately in the last couple of weeks at the Venice Film Festival, which was very exciting. I'd never been to the festival there before, or indeed to Venice, which is absolutely gorgeous. And it got a really good reaction, and hopefully we'll see it here sooner rather than later, though I think it might be early next year before we see it.
And are we in a world of fiction here?
It's a film that's based on a theatre piece that I wrote maybe 7-8 years ago called Trade, and I moved to Rialto, so I called it Rialto.
Trade was at that time was set.
It was site specific. It was set in a hotel room. It was very intense.
So you went into an hotel room, and there were two men.
Two men having a conversation.
Trade was happening in this hotel
room. There was a man with a...
How many audience members, if I remember?
We could fit 30 in there, but they were squashed in like as if... And it was very intense. Like you felt as if you were eavesdropping on them. So we took that text, and then I kind of opened it out forwards and backwards to see...
And how did you maintain that claustrophobia when you transferred to film, or did a different quality?
You literally had to remake it. You had to find a new language for it, and it becomes different. In fact, the ending of it had to change a little bit because it didn't quite fit when you move it from the theatrical kind of realm into film.
When might you see that?
Hope to see it in the springtime here, at the least. We're playing at the London Film Festival, and then it goes on to a festival circuit then, right. And we'll plan out a release.
Okay, and in the meantime... This is great because you've no dress rehearsal, you've no nothing, but a very big technical rehearsal, I would guess,
indeed,
for this push.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
It's been going on for 6 weeks.
Think of it right now, yeah. We previewed on Thursday night, this Thursday.
So. Okay, well, best of luck with that. That's Beckett's Room, a Gate Theatre and Dead Centre co-production. It opens at the Gate Theatre as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival, and that opening night is September the 24th, and you can find out full details on dublintheatrefestival.com.